Hello, everybody. Welcome to Media Voices, the podcast that casts a hopeful eye over the world of newspapers, magazines, digital media, and pretty much whatever else takes our fancy. If this is your first time listening to us, A, you've been missing out on some amazing content and post-credit scenes. But ahead of the news roundup this time, I'd like to ask that if you do enjoy this episode of Media Voices, please either review us on iTunes or recommend us to a friend. We want to grow and we want to continue doing what we love. Also, please do remember to sign up for our newsletter, which you can do by visiting voices.media.
I think there are some people that would definitely dispute that we cast a hopeful eye over the world.
Well, originally I had cynical there, but then I thought, well, I don't want to start the podcast on a downer. So rather than that, I thought, well, why not just lie?
Okay, great.
Yeah, much better. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
And I'm Esther Thorpe.
Esther, who did you talk to this week?
So this week I had a really great chat with Laura Jenner. She's the product director at Immediate Media. Gosh, that's a mouth. So we spoke about drawing together the needs and wants of different teams across the business, how the roles and responsibilities of a product manager kind of evolve in, you know, such a rapidly changing industry, and also why the relationship between product and editorial is so important.
But now the news roundup, and the Times and Sunday Times have turned a profit, whereas the Sun has posted a £91 million loss in the year to July 2018. So the publisher of the Sun newspaper's pre-tax losses more than tripled year on year, leading its publisher News Group Newspapers to report an operating loss of £64.6 million last year, which Huffington Post points out is a huge leap from the £7.7 million loss it made in 2017.
No, but I don't quite get this, because they've said that this is primarily driven by the decline in print newspaper circulation. But the Sun is also, I'm sure that the Sun is the second most visited website in the for UK news. So, I mean, what's kind of the story behind this?
Well, they've said that total advertising revenue for the year has increased for the first time in 7 years, which they are basically saying is based on their digital presence. At the same time, though, you know, and they're saying that continuing declines in print have been more than offset by growth in digital advertising. So on the one hand, having that scale is really good for them on an advertising point of view. But you know what the trends are like for print media.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, it's nice to see the thing about the Times as well, because, you know, we do look up to them a lot with a lot of the stuff they've done with their paywall. And I think that's probably really starting to, well, start to pay back. They've obviously been doing it for at least a decade, but it's nice to see that that milestone for them. And they've hit a number of milestones last year. So, yeah, that's great.
Well, you mentioned they have had this paywall for about a decade, and last year they're saying that subscriber numbers grew by 55,000 over the course of the year, which is the second biggest jump since the paywall was first introduced in 2010. That's kind of in line with what we're seeing, you know, in terms of people's propensity to pay online for quality news.
So, I mean, is this looking increasingly like are news brands able to sustain themselves online without that kind of that reader revenue, that the paid content aspect, if the Sun, as the second biggest news website in Britain, is struggling that much?
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. Well, it's, you know, in a lot of ways this is completely unsurprising, because the Sun has always had this problem. It couldn't support itself via a paywall, obviously, because people would not choose to pay for that. You know, whatever you think of their politics and how they actually, you know, do the journalism, a lot of what they did was very generic, and people proved that they would not pay for that, you know, when it introduced the paywall. I don't see them introducing that anytime soon. So advertising is basically the only way to go, with, you know, other sources of incidental revenue from, you know, events or some bets or whatever else they try. None of which, because I was thinking about this before the podcast, is there anything the Sun particularly is doing that you can see being sort of an industry leader or a thought leader for newspapers?
No, and I mean, you know, even, again, as much as I'm not a fan of the Daily Mail, that their app and the way that they're focused on their online experience has set them ahead in that sense. A lot of the innovations I know about the Sun have been print-based, and it's just, I can't think what they're doing is particularly unique now.
So it is doing something relatively interesting, which I think speaks to wider trends about getting people to sign up. You know, the more you know about your consumers, the more able you are to monetize them. So according to Press Gazette, the Sun also revealed its Sun Saver scheme, which rewards loyal readers with £5 cashback for every 28 codes scanned in papers, had turned more than 700,000, quote, previously anonymous print readers into known Sun Savers customers in the year since it was set up in June 2017. That is heartening for the Sun's business model. You know, having 700,000 people that it knows now is in a kind of much more concrete way than where they would just, you know, drive by anonymous readers. That is something.
So will we see them turn around that loss next year? Is that enough? Is that enough to stem that loss?
No way. absolutely.
Media Voices Productions.
It all reminds me of something that Emma Carew Grovem, who is founder of Diversity Journalism, said in Nyman Lab's 2019 prediction series. She said, "For years, we've seen news websites chasing bigger and bigger traffic gains. But the truth is, drive-by traffic is basically worthless," which I thought is kind of a nice way of putting, sure, scale is great for some things, but if for monetization, it's definitely not. It's, you know, they are, those eyeballs are A, fake from a lot of the time, and B, really, really hard to make any money off because they, you don't know.
Have you seen that report? It was something like 50 to 60% of all traffic on the internet is just bots.
Yeah, I saw that. That was the one that everything on the internet is fake. Moving on then, Media Voices understands that BBC journalists are to stop using the phrase BBC understands. So a memo that has been seen by BuzzFeed recommends that BBC journalists have been told to stop saying BBC understands because, quote, it's slightly pompous. So Gavin Allen, who's the head of news output for the BBC, said either it's true, and we know it, in which case just report the story, or we're unsure, in which case don't report it until we are. Do you kind of understand why, you know, they would be pushing this line now, why the BBC would suddenly decide that this tiny little bit of kind of what would have been minutiae has now become BBC policy?
You kind of ruined my response, which was going to be, I don't understand. this is just one of those, I think if it was any other news outlet using this, nobody cares, because it's the BBC, people kind of just harp on about it.
Yeah.
I thought it's one of those things that you just kind of say if you're not if you haven't verified the fact yourself, which seems to me to be entirely sensible.
Well, yeah. So this is BuzzFeed's Mark DeStefano effectively said that by using the phrase, the BBC would say, you know, using kind of linguistic sleight of hand to disguise the fact that they were reporting something that its journalists had seen elsewhere without wanting to give that other outlet credit, which I can see. But I almost wonder. And in that article, he cites a number of tweets that they've used where it's like, yeah, BBC understands that Theresa May, blah blah blah. But to me, I almost wonder if this is a sort of beam me up, Scotty situation where nobody actually ever said that in the initial Star Trek series, but everybody just thinks that the BBC constantly said BBC understands. It seems to me to be something that, you know, like chalk outlines in films. Police never actually use chalk outlines, but everybody just assumes that they did.
I feel like I'm going to go and open my BBC app after this and actually check how often this happens. But yeah, I think, yeah, it's just, you know, if you want to go for pompous phraseology, there are plenty of other outlets that are guilty of that. Just leave the BBC alone. You know, there's so much you could go at them for, like the fact that they keep getting Nigel Farage on to comment on Leaver stuff. Let's not pick on tiny phraseology. Let's kind of focus on the bigger issues here. I would make an atrocious politician.
I remember, this must be about 3-4 years ago now, and it was Reuters did a report into trust, you know, in public media. And, the response was kind of, people will just accuse the BBC of bias either way because it has this remit to be impartial and people cannot recognise impartiality because they are themselves biased. So this to me just seems to be an attempt by maybe Gavin Allen to say, we cannot please everybody, but for the love of God, can we just try and mitigate it a little bit by not using phrases like BBC understands?
I put a lot of money on the fact that most normal people don't care, haven't noticed, and a number of other things. What other journalism tradition would you get rid of?
Because I was thinking about this, and I was like, well, that is, as you mentioned, kind of a very tiny change. But what other journalistic traditions do we have that we should get rid of now? New year, new broom. And I think mine is title case, you know, capitalizing the first letter of each word in a headline.
Because I hate that.
I hate it so fucking much. And part of the problem is because we do this podcast, we're often copying headlines in so we can refer back to them later. And it sticks out like a sore thumb. And worse, it leads people on Twitter to think that this is how you type. The number of people I've seen who type in title case is just insane.
I think I would get rid of reporting the other side of the story just because it's the other side of the story.
Oh, yeah. So that both sidesism thing. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah. You know, balance with the snake of balance. And again, I know that's something the BBC gets a lot of, is not balance. Next up, UK-based fact-checking charity Full Fact is on board. I did it.
Sorry, I didn't realise that I'd written a tongue twister there.
So they've come on board to review stories, images and videos which have been flagged by users and rate them based on their accuracy on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And I think that their remit is specifically focused around information that is especially damaging. So, you know, the fake medical information, fake election info. And then they're going to do a Snopes-like rating of true and not true. Do you remember? I'm sure there's an American fact-checking company that were working with Facebook that actually ended up kind of chucking the relationship because Facebook were being really pushy on what was let through.
Yeah, that absolutely doesn't surprise me. You know, if you look into what's happening with the story, people have already sort of raised some red flags about the power that Facebook has over this.
Well, I think that the interesting thing about that compared to a lot of the other fact-checking initiatives that they've introduced, and my goodness, I've lost track of them now. There are so many.
Well, they come and go as well on Facebook.
I know, because there was all sorts of stuff about, you had to rate the publishers you saw and how trustworthy they are. But that doesn't address the way that quite a lot of fake news ends up being shared, which is memes.
Mm.
That they are so, it's very, very difficult to fact check a picture.
It's very hard to push AI. Back against. Yeah, it's very hard to push back against your grandma when she's sending you a meme.
That does bring me on to something I saw this week, which I thought was brilliant. So there was a study that found that people over 65 share the most fake news. It was a big like study into where all this stuff is actually being shared, and it turns out it's not the young people. This group found that it didn't matter whether you're Democrat, Republican, Conservative, like whatever sort of. Whatever your political alignment was, your age was actually way better at predicting whether you were more likely to share fake news. So people aged 65 plus shared twice as much fake news as the next oldest age group, which was 45 to 65. And then they shared nearly seven times as much as young people.
Jesus Christ. Did they offer any explanations why?
Not explanations that I think any listeners over 65 would like.
Well, is it sort of set in their ways, jaded, you know, incapable of understanding technology? Was it just everything rolled up in one big geriatric?
The primary reason they gave is that if you've not grown up on the internet, or at least grown up significantly around the internet, that you've not got that kind of thing of distinguishing whether something you read is true or false.
Yeah.
It's just digital skills, and that people can and have picked them up quite quickly, even in middle age. It's just the old people that can't.
Yeah, sorry, I completely understand. No, it's fair. Nobody over 65 listens to the podcast.
Oh, I've waddled over to my computer on my cane. Oh, somebody shared some information. It must be true.
Your poor grandma.
So from Press Gazette, though, Claire Wardle, who is the executive director of First Draft, which worked with Full Fact on the 2017 general election, said the biggest problem is that Facebook holds all the information about the project, which is making it almost impossible for independent auditors to see whether it is working or not. Facebook's, again, opacity around this is just causing more problems than it's solving. They have to be seen to be doing something, but really without kind of the metrics, without any KPIs that we can see. What's the point?
And also, they need to start getting ahead of where else people are sharing fake news. Like, you know, they've barely made a dent on the issues of WhatsApp.
It's people wanting a technological solution to a human problem. Yeah. People will create and share misinformation. They will choose to believe what they want to believe. And it kind of, all you can do is try and build a bit of a breakwater to contain it rather than stopping people sharing it completely.
So what you're saying is you need human editors, is that the word?
Well, I don't think... Human editors? I don't think that's a thing. That can't be a thing.
I mean, they've tried that and then they fired them all.
Who? Wait, come... No, come on. What, Facebook making the problem work? Come on now. No way.
So, I thought this was quite interesting this week. Courts have launched an AI studio to help journalists write better data-driven stories. And they've not kind of said much about how it actually works, but it's. I think the idea is if you're a journalist, even if you've got no kind of maths and coding skills, which data-driven journalism is traditionally needed. They've sort of put together all these open source tools that you can actually use to try and use data to inform your stories a bit better. So I thought that was really cool.
It is. This is from the journalism.co.uk article about it. And this is a fantastic quote from John Keefe, who is Quartz's technical architect for bots and machine learning. He said, "But for the machine learning, we think we can help support reporters. The applications are far more specific. More like, computer, here are 100 examples of the pattern I'm looking for. Please find more of those in this pile of 1 million records," which is, you know, that is a very valuable tool if, you know, if it works. That is how they catch murderers.
And I also think it's just nice to see a publisher building something that is kind of open to everybody. I think, and they're running all these sorts of workshops and stuff about training journalists to use data better. And that's really nice.
It is. This is building on what Quartz has done before, you know, but if you look at it, like Atlas, which was their, you know, graphing software that they made open and available for everybody, seems hopelessly quaint now compared to this kind of AI tool for journalists.
I guess it's one of the things that if you don't want a robot to take your job, learn how to use the robot.
Well, this is exactly it. Can I just point out one last thing on this? They've also launched a dedicated Slack bot for journalists, which is called Quackbot, which I think is excellent.
Gold star for courts this week.
Hey, speaking of journalism, I love being a journalist. I don't love every part of being a journalist. And one of the worst parts is transcription. So now that we use Trint for this, it's kind of a bit of an interesting tool because it works a lot better than you might expect. You know, there are all those horror stories about sort of automated voice recognition stuff. But this tends to work pretty well. So yeah, we use Trint to transcribe all our interviews. And you can get those transcriptions by signing up.
So we've actually got a special transcription section on our website, which has got links to how you can sort of get to know a bit more about Trint. And it's also got all the links to our transcriptions. So if you just go to our website at voices.media, there's a little bit on the sidebar that says click here for our transcripts. So that's got a bit more info about Trint.
And speaking of the interviews that we do, who did you talk to this week?
This week I spoke to Laura Jenner. So she's the product director at Immediate Media. And before she became product director, she was focused on Immediate's Radio Times website and sort of told me on that. So I started off by asking her what it was like going from working on a single site and brand to managing products across almost the entire portfolio and all the different teams and brands at Immediate.
It's a funny one, isn't it? Because I manage a lot of, but not in all of, because of our structure, the product team, who themselves work on our kind of publishing platform, and some of them are in brand. So while we have a loose track, it's like 37 digital brands or something like that, it's probably more. We don't have like a product manager in each of those teams. So we work with the brand teams almost when it's appropriate because of platform development we're doing. Yeah. I think I was looking at this and the challenges that came up, the big kind of changes were partly domain knowledge. If you're working on one brand, it's lovely because you can really, really deep dive into it, learn about it, you know, all the foibles of the content management system and all that kind of thing. And going across multiple ones meant a kind of thinner spread of domain knowledge in some cases. That's quite challenging. Brings in people management. You know, product manager doesn't usually manage anyone in the development team, so you're kind of slightly standalone. But when all of a sudden you're across multiple teams, then you're dealing with the overheads of people as well as products. I don't mean that in a negative way. It's the vast majority of the job once you go over a certain size. And then it's the prioritization piece around resource. I think that's probably common across many, many organizations, that as soon as you've got, instead of having a brand that has a team, you have, I don't know, five teams and 25 brands, you're having to make some choices around who gets what, when, and why. Which is a fairly constant juggle. I suspect it's true of every product manager everywhere. And once you start going across multiple publications or products in different sectors, that and the people are probably the primary focus. And that's the real difference. It's not what shall we do that makes the most sense this year with the resource that we have in our team. It's, okay, which projects for which brands and which teams are the best ones to get started on now, which is an interesting set of juggling.
And how do you kind of balance those priorities on a day-to-day basis? Because I imagine everybody thinks that their own site or product is the most important. How do you kind of communicate that back to them that actually there's a priority list?
No, they're all entirely rational. No, I think that's probably the biggest challenge, and I'm not going to claim to have cracked that one at all. I think it's really hard. Especially, and it links into you. I know you wanted to know about the kind of migration project we're working on at the moment. Those two things kind of come together because one of the issues that we had, and I know speaking to other kind of big publishers, they have or have had similar, is that where we Immediate has grown massively over the last kind of 5 to 8 years through acquisition, and every time we've acquired brands or publications, they've often come with their own content management system. So I think at one point we were running 8 different CMSs. And that means that even if you have a great idea about something you want to build, for example, let's say, I don't know, galleries is a classic example from the past. At one point, I think we had 4 different teams developing galleries and they couldn't be shared because of the different tech stacks. So at that point, the prioritization, the resource juggling is really difficult because it's not that you can just say, oh yeah, we've got this awesome gallery solution, let's build that. It's okay, we can build an awesome gallery solution for these brands, but it won't work for these ones over here. And that really didn't help with some of the prioritization that we had to do. now that we're moving them all onto the same CMS, the aim on that is very much about partly not duplicating effort from, you know, very high cost development resource. And partly that if you are a smaller brand in the portfolio, you're on a bespoke CMS, you're not going to benefit from anything that we do for a bigger brand, because it's the return on investment is maybe not high enough. However, if on a shared CMS, if we build something for, I don't know, Radio Times, let's say, then even some of the kind of more specialist brands in our portfolio can benefit from that functionality, and that helps them. So that's been the major aim of it, was kind of streamlining that tech effort. It's not meant, I don't mean streamlining resource, or we've not got smaller, we've got bigger, but being able to look at features, tools, services, not just through the lens of one brand for whom they would make a significant difference, but what's their kind of generic heart and how can other brands use that and benefit as well.
Has there ever been a limit to that? So one site wants something particular in the way that their site works that you've sort of not going to be able to implement across everything else?
It would be unusual. We have, say, TV listings on radiotimes.com. That's not really required as a component on other sites. It could be that we create a way for them to surface a set of listings, but that's reasonably bespoke. But it's quite unusual. Most things we're finding have a kind of generic heart to them, even if actually they look like a very specialized section for the let's say the lead brand for whom they were built specifically, but actually there's functionality in them that can be used elsewhere. A good example of that is on gardenersworld.com, which is one of ours. There's a 2-for-1 garden section. It's a huge thing for the magazine, because if you buy that the May issue, you get 2-for-1 entry to lots of gardens across the UK. And we had moved the website onto our new platform, and we could have built a 2-for-1 garden section, and it would only really have been much use to Gardeners World. But what the team built was a venues section. So it is absolutely what Gardeners World need for 2-for-1 gardens, but it's also being used on one of our cycling titles to have cycling trails and where they are and what facilities they have and all that kind of stuff. Although it was very much built with one brand in mind, they were the primary customer, for want of a better phrase, actually, the technology that underlies it, the function in the CMS, is available for others to use if they want to.
So it's just sort of rethinking the product in a way that other people could use it rather than just make it niche.
And we may well come across stuff where it's like, you know what, this is just something that brand X needs, and it's a massive benefit to their customers, and it's got huge revenue potential, in which case it's worth it. You know, there's no reason we can't do that. We would always try and say, is there something in here that could have an application elsewhere? Or if you let editorial teams loose, often they'll find an application for something that you'd never have thought of. which is another reason for making it available, is if they can use it creatively to become something they want, then that's always interesting. But it does. It just depends on the business case for that feature, as it would do in any other setup. If there's a huge return on the investment, even if it's just for one brand, then you'd be silly not to do it.
Yeah. And you walk across a number of different teams in your day-to-day role. How do you kind of draw together what a lot of those teams will need and want into a cohesive product strategy?
Badly? No. At the moment, most of our focus is still on migration, and that sort of makes it easier because we know what. So for each migration, we've generally had to add some kind of feature to the CMS that brand requires but hasn't been required before. So mapping that work across multiple teams is challenging, and we're lucky to have a very, very able product manager kind of leading the CMS development who's really good at looking at multiple rows of detail and figuring out how they all fit together. But a lot of it's been looking at like what is the primary project, what are the things that are needed for it or getting in its way, and how do we solve those, and then is there anything else we can do alongside? We've not stopped doing commercial development, for example, because that would be mental. We've still got to make money in the meantime. So it's mostly looking at where the highest business value is, focusing on that and anything migration related. When we come out the other side of the migrations, it becomes a slightly different picture, and we can actually look at kind of project by project or work stream by work stream. What are the highest priorities for that work stream? And then just try and make sure those are, any dependencies are coordinated. But the teams are fairly autonomous, so it's not like any of us have to tell all the teams what to do day to day. They're running that as an agile process, and it's more tracking where we are against the business milestones we need to hit that takes the central coordination.
You've written quite a bit about what the role of product manager involves. Why do you think the relationship between product and editorial is so important?
I think partly because I'm completely biased. I've always worked in media and I absolutely love it. And I come from an editorial background, so I may be slightly biased. However, I was thinking about this. I think one of the interesting things about working on product in media, so with kind of journalists and editors and content creators of all kinds, is that the success of your product, unlike most, if not all, other industries, is not necessarily based on the work that you do. Because the reason that readers or users or customers or whatever you want to call them come to the product is because of what the editorial team create, and then what you're layering around it and how you're presenting it and what other things you're offering to that user help, but that's not their primary purpose. If you're a national newspaper, people aren't, they might be coming for the crosswords, but they, which counts as content, they're not coming because you've created a wicked new widget in the sidebar. They're coming because they want to consume the content. And then, you know, the fact that you've made it render fast and effectively on a mobile phone is it's a very important secondary consideration, but it's not the thing they came for. And I think it's really easy to underestimate how strongly journalists, editors, content creators feel about their brands. And it's a terrifying mistake to make if you do, because while you feel deeply invested in the brand and you feel like it's your product, kind of, you have to be so, so mindful that to all intents and purposes, it's not. You know, the relationship is with the content creators and the readers, and that has changed over time, but you're kind of sitting alongside that and making it the best it can be. You're making that user experience the best it can be around the content that they have chosen to consume. I've been really lucky to work with amazing editorial teams, so you never have any concern about the quality of what people are landing on. You're just trying to make it the best possible experience once they get there. But you're dependent on that external creation. Whereas if I was thinking about Bulb, the energy provider, they have a lovely app. It's really nice product development. But you have not, you know, if you, as a consumer of it, you don't really care about the electricity or the gas. That just turns up, right? Your experience is with the product that they have developed to help you manage your account. Whereas if you're working on a content-led site, they're coming for the actual content and you're there to make that experience great. So I think it is a really important relationship. Wouldn't claim to have always got it right, but I think it's important to invest the time and energy in, at the very least, understanding how important it is to content creators that they can work efficiently because they're also a customer if you're building out a content management system, and that they feel that their users are being well served when they come. So I do think it's quite and especially if you're the product manager for an editorial brand and that's your baby too, then it's particularly important. And then, you know, for us it's slightly different because when we're working across migrations, but even then it's making sure that people are as happy as they can be with what we're delivering.
Yes, and I suppose that the same is true that in some ways it doesn't matter how good the editorial is, if it takes sort of 10 minutes to load on a mobile phone, people are going to be really turned off it.
Yeah, although people tend to find a way around awful experiences if they like what's there. That's not to say that's what we should aim at, clearly, but they're much more forgiving of something that they really care about than they would be if it was just a kind of, they're just diving in to find out one thing and then leaving again. And often they'll actually bother to get in touch with you if they really care, which is also helpful because then you know it's going wrong. But yeah, I mean, you're right. If something takes more than your kind of Google's mandatory 3 seconds to load, then you may have lost them. And in which case you have let down not just that customer, but the editorial team who created content that you have failed to serve up to somebody who was looking for it.
No pressure then.
No, none at all. None at all. There's a reason that pubs near publishers are always full.
And you've been a product manager in various roles for quite some time. And in that time, the media world has sort of changed very, very quickly. How has the role of product manager changed over your career?
So, I mean, I think one of the changes is that the role exists. When I started out in kind of editorial production, we didn't have product managers. You had managing editor was more similar in that you were often kind of project managing changes or redesigns or something like that. So that's changed. I think one of the things that's changed since the kind of glorious early days when people were just accessing websites on desktops at work because they didn't have broadband, so you were basically catering for one screen size between the hours of 9 and 5, is that you've got multiple platforms, you've got multiple devices, which is a massive challenge, as we all know. I think the expectations of performance are much higher. I mean, in the early 2000s, you were used to pages loading, you know, kind of not super quick and waiting for them to turn up. And now you expect on 3G on your phone for something to render as quickly as it used to on a desktop on a kind of a broadband connection.
And I mean, that change has come very quickly. It's only really been the last sort of 5-6 years.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there was talk of, you know, the year of mobile for about 5 years, and then all of a sudden we were all over it and mobile had been and gone and just was now the de facto normal. That's really changed. I think things like programmatic ads, ad blocking, the constant need for novelty, but also the knowledge that you're competing with tech giants who are kind of eating so much of people's time, which is, you know, no bad thing. It's consumer choice. But at one point, you would only look at your fellow publications as rivals, whereas now I think it's well covered that we're all trying to get the time that people aren't spending on Facebook, Instagram, BBC News.
Has there been a shift with sort of commercial challenges as well?
I think so. I mean, the growth of programmatic ads has been really interesting because you went from wanting to have some ad units that you could sell at a high price to having 3,000 ad units per page, which was slightly less than awesome. And then funnily enough, the challenge of ad blocking came along. I think there's always been the need for novelty. Everybody still wants that media first. And that's quite a challenge. I think looking at multiple revenue streams, because advertising is useful, but it's not... it's proving to not be the kind of be-all and end-all for digital properties. So where you just used to think about, like, where can we put some ads? Now it's more, actually, is there a different revenue stream that would optimise this content better without kind of breaking the UX? It's definitely a different kind of challenge.
And has the shift back to paid content, we talk about this a lot on the podcast, but has that affected how you as a product manager is seen within a media business?
I think it's created new roles for products in media businesses. I think it's shifted the balance a little bit in not like a balance of power, but a balance of how things are thought about, in that the kind of mechanisms that you need to process even just transactions, but also propensity to pay, the data collection and analysis, the kind of levels of testing that you have to do to prove out any kind of reader revenue model, are not something you would expect the editorial teams to do necessarily. So I think there's a different kind of relationship with the consumer when you're saying to them, not just, hey, look, this is awesome, but hey, look, this is awesome, and if you want to read it, you're going to have to register or come into some kind of value exchange with us. It arguably, we've moved to a more kind of customer-centric, even more customer-centric approach because of that, because it's no longer... I think this is probably one of the shifts. I know you guys have talked about it before anyway, but it's no longer kind of this is what the editorial teams think should be published today. It's also factoring in what kinds of content are resonating, where are we seeing engagement, what kinds of articles or content is driving people to register or subscribe, and how can we focus on optimizing those. So I think it changes that discussion around what is the best, what is the next best action for this user, from just being, well, here's another article I've written or another video or audio, to is it something they want to purchase, register, subscribe to? And that kind of customer journey discussion becomes really key for product and engineering and commercial and editorial, but with product at the centre of that, trying to bring it all together.
And given it's such a quickly growing role, if you had one piece of advice for other product managers in publishing, what would that be?
So this is a really difficult one, I think, because it kind of implies that like you have the answers. I mean, I think if you're already in publishing, you probably know all this stuff already. So to me, it's more about if you wanted to start in product and publishing, it's making sure that you're aware of the wider media and the challenges that present to it. So not just, you know, is this any good and is the website fast, but what are the challenges around recurring reader revenue and what are the opportunities in commerce and how can you create a really good customer experience on a phone, which is hard in itself, that plays not just to the strength of the content, but also to the opportunities you have for that next best step for the customer. I think it's thinking, you have to think quite broadly and you have to get to know the editorial and commercial teams really, really well so that you can start to really feel what they feel for the brands you're working on, which may or may not be helpful. That and over-communicate at every opportunity would be the other one.
And the last thing we ask all our guests is, what's the last thing you read, saw or heard which really affected you?
I saw War Horse, the production of War Horse at Christmas, which is not the most Christmassy thing to go to at the theatre, as it turns out. That was awesome and incredibly moving, partly because it's quite painful to watch. In terms of reading, there are two. So I recently read Michelle Obama's book, which, despite making me feel completely inadequate in almost every way, had some really moving passages, actually, where she was talking about kind of personal loss, which is unfortunately fairly pertinent, but who they were quite powerful stories and she carried them across well. And the last thing that made my blood boil was an article on The Atlantic, which is called New Authoritarians Are Waging War on Women, which is quite a timely reminder, I thought, a beautiful bit of journalism for a start, but also a timely reminder that although we've had Me Too and things are much better than they were even kind of 15 years ago, there's a whole generation of politicians who are doing their best to kind of reassert a very old-fashioned domination over kind of powerful female opponents. It just made me really cross, but that probably means it's worth reading.
So thank you very much for listening to us this week. As ever, we're going to be back next week with another fantastic guest. But in the meantime, if you're craving some Media Voices content, please do go to voices.media and sign up for our weekly newsletter. It contains a sort of mini article that we write about everything we've learned from our interview guest that week, plus curated links to what we've been writing and reading from around the internet. It's basically just a very comprehensive newsletter. We're quite proud of it. So I think go and sign up, voices.media.
And if you want to keep up with what we do during the week, pretty much all the news we discuss goes out on our Twitter first. You can follow us over at Media Voices Pod, or I'm at Esther Keziah T.
And I am on Twitter at Chris M. Sutcliffe.
So until next week, when we'll be back with another great guest. Bye-bye.
Bye.